Miracles. The fourth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on November 14, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week, we looked at Numbers 13 and 14, and there were some questions that were raised, so I'm going to stop today and address those questions. First was a question that four different people asked, so I think it needs to be talked about. And that's the nature of God's interaction with Moses in these chapters. Then the other issue is a question. Kurt asked a question last week about the miracles, and I also received an email from Bob Blanchard raising a number of issues along those lines. So my intention is to just say a few words about miracles and then throw it open for people to either ask other questions or make their own observations or their comments. And I plan to leave most of the time to do that. And then if there is time, in the last 5 minutes or so, I'd like to make a few more comments about last week. So the first thing, God's interaction with Moses. If you'll recall, in chapters 13 and 14, I can't remember which one it is that God, it's in 14 that God comes to Moses after the people have been told to go into the promised land and take it, and they refuse to do so. God speaks to Moses and he says, Moses, why don't you just stand back and I'll nuke them? That's my paraphrase. And I'll start over with you. So I'll just clean the slate and I'll start over with you. And Moses' response is, no, you can't do that. That would be terrible. So the question is, why does God raise that question? Is God really trying to decide? And I think in the context of the rest of the Old Testament, that cannot be the case. It cannot be the case that God is asking the question and he doesn't really know what he's going to do. I think that would be in conflict. Certainly in my looking at Genesis, that would be in complete conflict with what's going on in Genesis. But the point of Genesis, one of the major points of Genesis, is that God is indeed in control of everything that happens. And he has foreseen these things. He knows where he's going. He knows what he's doing and why he's doing it. So why would he come to Moses with this question? Well, I think he's doing it this way for Moses' benefit. And I was trying to think of a good example of this, and I did not come up with a good example of this, but I did come up with a bad example of this. I mean, if think about a situation in which a parent and a child are sitting at the dinner table, and the child is resistant to eating her vegetables. And the parent says, just sits back and says, I'm not going to eat my vegetables. Or should I eat my vegetables? It's not because the parent is deliberating, but the parent is inviting the child to look at the situation through more mature eyes. And to think about that from, isn't that inconsistent with being grown up? Isn't that inconsistent with the way that a parent acts? And I think God is doing a similar kind of thing with Moses here. He's inviting Moses to look at the situation from God's perspective. What would God do in this situation? And Moses' conclusion is, God would not just wipe everybody out. and start afresh. Why not? And he gives two reasons. One is because everybody looking on would think that God did that because he was incapable of working with this people and bringing them into the promised land. And that would be horrible. And the other thing he says is it would be inconsistent with the nature of God as it has been manifested up until now. God is loyal. God is forgiving. God is patient. And so this kind of response would not be the kind of response that it's in keeping with God's character. So I don't think it's God is actually asking for counsel. God is inviting Moses to look at this through mature eyes. And Moses does. Which is very interesting because in just the chapter before, three chapters before, we noticed that Moses lost perspective when the people were rebellious. And his response was, God, why do I have to work with these people? Why did you put me in this position? So it's a very mature response on Moses' part, and it's a right response. He understands. He understands God's character and what God would do in this situation, and it is not to start over from the beginning. Okay. Now, the miracles. Now, the question on the miracles came up with respect to what it talks about in chapter 11, I think it is, when the people of Israel complained that they didn't have meat. And God responds by giving them meat. And the way that he does that is he sends quail. The quail come and the quail fall to the ground in huge numbers, and the children of Israel are able to just go out and gather them up, gather up the quail and eat that meat. And I had suggested that there is a natural phenomenon in that area where migrating quail sometimes are carried south by the winds. And by the time they reach the Sinai, having gone over the Mediterranean Sea where they could not land, by the time they reach Sinai, they're exhausted and they fall to the ground and could be readily picked up. And the question was, well, is there any value in looking for a naturalistic explanation for a miracle that's being performed by God? And in fact, might that not be harmful to look for a naturalistic explanation, that it would actually take away from our understanding? So I'd like to talk about miracles just a little bit, and then I want to throw it open for you to be able to make your comments. I am not an authority on miracles. This is not something that I have thought a lot about. So all I'm going to be doing is making a few comments that are preliminary and hopefully will spark your thinking, and we can talk about it. One thing that I think that is clear, and I think is would be common ground for most of us, is that everything that happens in this world is the activity of God. That absolutely everything, God is sovereign over what happens in this world. So everything that happens is ultimately his activity. It all stems back to him. And God transcends this world. God is not a part of creation. God is the creator. He is not subject to creation. He is the master over creation. He is the creator of what is. So he is truly transcendent. So there's a sense in which everything that happens is is orchestrated, is brought about by the supernatural, that which transcends the natural world. What is nature then? How do we characterize it? Well, the way I think of it is, nature is this this normal behavior. God has decided that the universe is going to run according to in a certain pattern, according to certain rules, rules that He Himself established. So if I have a pencil and I let go of it, it falls. And if I do it 100 times, it falls 100 times. Why? Because God chose to build that principle into reality such that it happens time after time after time. So when God is doing his thing, although He's transcendent and ultimately the one who is behind everything that happens, He has decided to do that through the means of an ordered system of rules. He has decided to constrain Himself to that ordered system of rules. Why would He do that? Because God is a God of order. And I think that's one of the important things that we see in Genesis chapter 1. God is orderly. Things need to be in their place. Things need to be rightly divided. Things need to be organized. And I would say they need to be organized because God is rational, and He made us to be rational. We are perceivers of order. That's a lot of our rationality is that we are perceivers of pattern and order and can extrapolate from that. And if God was to make the world intelligible, it had to be orderly and patterned. Okay, so God is acting all the time, but it's when He acts according to those rules, it's not obvious that He's working. It's easy for us to say, oh, that's just the way things are. That's just chemistry and physics, as opposed to God's activity. But there are times when God has chosen to act in history in a way that is overt. For the most part, the universe goes along according to the normal patterns, and it's easy to ascribe what's happening just to chemistry and physics. But there are times when God wants to get our attention, and He wants to reach into history and act in a way that is overt such that it grabs our attention, and we have to say, what's going on here? And those are the signs and the wonders. Those are the miracles, I think. Now, the question is, when He does that, does He violate the rules of physics and chemistry? Now, it's important to understand that I certainly am not questioning whether God can violate the rules of physics and chemistry. I have no problem with that. I'm convinced that He can. The question is, does He? When He performs these signs, does He abrogate the patterns? Does He deviate from the patterns that He has established completely? That is, does He violate the rules of chemistry and physics that He has established, or does He not? Now, the possible answers are, yes, He does violate them. That is, these are acts that are outside of physics and chemistry. They are completely other. The other possibility is, no, even in these acts, He abides by the rules of chemistry and physics, but He brings those laws together in a way that something very extraordinary happens. Now, how can that be then characterized as a miracle. How can that accomplish the purposes of being a sign? And I think that what's important here is whichever perspective you take, God's signs occur in a context. That is, the thing that makes them arresting, the thing that makes them meaningful, is that they occur in a context that He has established. They are conjoined with a context in which you say, oh, God's doing something here. Apart from the context, if they were just random weird things that happened out there, it wouldn't be meaningful. Here's what I mean. Moses, when he parted the waters of the Red Sea, and he held out the staff, and the waters separated, that is a sign in a context. It happened right when he points his staff out over the sea. If at some random time the Red Sea split, that would not be a sign. What would you make of it? But if it's right when God tells Moses to raise his staff, then we've got a context that makes it meaningful. So it seems to me that whether you think that God violates the rules of chemistry and physics or not, signs only occur in a context which gives them meaning. Now, let's think about this in the context of the incident with the quail. There is recorded the observation. It is recorded by Aristotle makes this observation, and there is an Arabic writer writing in the 14th century who makes the same observation, that there is this phenomenon in which quail are blown south by the winds across the Mediterranean Sea, and when they arrive in the Sinai, they are exhausted and they fall down on the ground. So there is such a phenomenon attested to by historical sources. Historical sources, by the way, that would have to probably have no knowledge of the Old Testament account. Now, the writer in the 14th century, the Arabic writer, may have had some familiarity with it. Aristotle would be less likely to have familiarity with the Old Testament account. So, with the quail incident, there are two ways that we could see this. One is, what happened is similar to a known phenomenon, but in fact has nothing to do with that known phenomenon. What God did was a violation of the laws of physics and chemistry to perform this miracle of providing meat to the Israelites. That is possible. The other possibility is that, yes, there is a natural phenomenon that is similar to this, but in this instance and in this context, God did it in a way that was highly unusual, but did not violate the natural order. What makes it a sign? What makes it a miracle? Because of the context in which it was done. It happened right when the Israelites were complaining about their need for meat, and then God had them consecrate themselves, and the next day the event with the quail happened. Does a miracle, does a sign have to be contrary to physics in order to be compelling? It does not seem to me that it does need to be. It could be, but it doesn't need to be. If it needs to be contrary to the principles of physics in order to be compelling, God could have made it even more miraculous. I mean, it is interesting that He uses quail, which inhabit that part of the world, and they're carried there by the wind, which is a natural phenomenon. If He wanted to have it truly contrary to the laws of physics and science, He could have had instantaneously beefsteaks all over the Sinai Desert. But he does use natural phenomena in some way to carry it out. So what does a sign or a miracle require? It seems to me that the important thing is that there be the context. There has to be the context that gives this unusual event meaning. Then we have an event that is highly unusual, such that it is arresting. It grabs a person's attention. Does it have to break the natural laws? It seems to me that it could. That's possible. It is absolutely possible that it would break the rules of physics and chemistry. But it seems to me that it is also possible that it doesn't break the rules of physics and chemistry, that those laws are just coming together in a configuration that's extremely unusual. The other possibility is that sometimes signs are of one kind and sometimes signs are of the other kind. That is to say, some signs are indeed according to the natural laws of physics and chemistry, and other signs are not. Either way, it seems to me they can still be signs. And so if there is a naturalistic interpretation or explanation given for a sign, I'm, at least the way I'm thinking about it, it doesn't bother me. Okay. I think that's all I had to say. So let's open it up. Whatever comments you want to make, they don't have to be questions. If you have some insight or comment, that's perfectly wonderful.
Okay, so let me get this right. You're saying that God is incapable of exhibiting a non sequitur. Logically, he just doesn't work outside that box, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, God can transcend and choose to not work within the boundaries of a construct that he makes, the earth, the physical laws. He can violate those if he wants. See, I'm not so sure that I agree with that. I'm not so sure that there's a difference, and I could be talked out of this, between the laws of logic and God not being able to violate those, and God creating a context with its laws and not violating those laws that govern that box.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is true that God does not violate the laws of logic, the principles of logic. He is a rational God. I'm not sure that it necessarily follows that he has to abide by the laws of physics that he has established. I don't know. But I don't think that it necessarily follows.
Yeah, I would agree with you, David, that the laws of physics and chemistry certainly seem to have been established by God. He could have done things a different way. I mean, if you think of it at the most basic level, or one of the, at least at a very basic level, the charges that are on atomic particles, I mean, those could certainly be different than they are, and that would change pretty much everything as far as I understand it.
Yeah.
And if God wanted to do things in a way that was different than the normal way that he did things, I don't see that as a logical problem.
Right. And I think it seems to me that it comes down to the extent to which God has committed himself to abiding by the laws of physics and chemistry that he has established. Did he decide from the very beginning, I will not abrogate those in this world? Or did he decide, that's the way I'm usually going to operate, but I reserve for myself the right to abrogate those laws in certain circumstances, And I don't know which of those God chose.
Where would you put resurrection into this whole picture?
Well, there are some signs that are, it seems to me, it is more thinkable to see them as being inconsistent with the laws of physics and chemistry than others. There are some that I cannot imagine how they would be consistent with the natural laws. However, I am convinced that God made the majority of the natural laws relatively simple, such that we can actually figure them out and make progress. Could there be orders of complexity that we cannot even imagine? And I think the answer is yes. I mean, I think of chemistry, and in chemistry they tell me that this podium is mostly space, empty space. I take that on faith because it doesn't appear to be so. That's a whole higher, whole different level of complexity. Now let's say it could be that those laws go, that there are levels of complexity beyond that that are genuinely unimaginable to us, profoundly unimaginable to us, such that if we knew all of those, that even these signs could be explained according to those rules.
I guess I'll come back to a point that I made in my email. I used the word evidentiary, serving as evidence for something.
Right.
And I think miracles or signs are maybe always, but certainly most of the time, given as evidence of something that God wants to communicate. Let's take Jesus turning the water to wine. Okay. I did a little bit of study about the words that the Bible uses for a miracle, and they're not really conclusive in terms of the nature of the act or the event. But he, once again, there was a context for that sign, and I think that's an excellent point that you made, that otherwise they would just be random weird things that happen. It's hard for me to imagine natural laws, the way things normally happen, resulting in water turning into wine just by sitting in large pots.
Right.
And they said it was the good stuff. It wasn't
right.
It wasn't just any old wine.
Right.
You know,
I can imagine it turning into bad wine. I can't imagine it turning into good wine.
So, and to me, part of the evidentiary worth of that event would seem to derive from the supernaturalness of it rather than merely the timing of it. Can you address that?
Well, it could be. It could be. I just in my the way I think about it, it doesn't make that much difference to me whether it is highly unusual or whether it is an actual abrogation of the natural laws, because it's the context that really makes it significant. If it's something that happens once a year, that makes it less significant. If it's something that happens once every million years, that makes it more significant. But I it seems to me it could be circumstantial, that the sign is circumstantial evidence.
David, can you talk about maybe this will get at Bob's question a little bit better. Can you talk about the first three miracles that Moses did when he was bringing the lands? It seemed like the magicians could do the same thing, and there
right.
seems to be a point at which the miracles seemed like miracles,
mm-hmm.
the first three,
Right.
But at some level, they went from being something that man could do to something that only that became a signature for God.
Right. Right. That's true. And I don't know if you're going from there, that which way you're going then. Does that mean that they had to violate the laws of nature? It seems to me, I don't see that that decides that issue yet. I mean, maybe it does, but I don't know that it still decides the issue.
I'm not really trying to address that question.
Okay.
But I think that for it to become evidentiary or compelling,
mm-hmm.
there's some characteristic of the subsequent miracles that made them more compelling than the first three, because
right.
the first three could be done by
right.
Pharaoh's magicians.
Right, right, right. So it has to be something that is so unusual that it can't be imitated.
Bob and I had a long talk about this question. It was fun. And one of the things that crossed my mind from that discussion, the things we talked about, is that it seems to me that what's at stake, certainly in the accounts in the Pentateuch, that the issue is the question of the power of God,
mm-hmm.
that there is nothing in creation that can dictate to him what's going to go on.
Right.
Because the issue is, we're crazy to have followed him into the desert. But what he's demonstrating is, you want meat? I can just snap my fingers and you'll have meat.
Right.
And so what's significant, that's related to what you're saying about the context, is the miracles are demonstrating. I mean, one of the words that's used that we translate as miracle sometimes is the word for power.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that power is being demonstrated. So in the end, the question is, am I a fool or am I wise to follow this God into the desert where there's no food and there may be no water? And in the end, I mean, the fact is that I can't snap my fingers and make quail be blown in over the Mediterranean. It may be a natural phenomenon, but if I'm hungry and I need meat, there's nothing I can do to make that happen.
Right.
But the God that I'm following is demonstrating over and over again, you know, there's a sea in the way between, I'm blocked with a sea on one side and an army on the other side. Well, God will just part it and I'll just walk across.
Right.
If we were to discover someday, if it were to happen again, the winds were to blow and somehow the current gets going and it was to part, it wouldn't change the fact that the issue was, I'm following a God who can rescue me from the Egyptian army by making the sea part.
Right.
So in the end, I mean, it's not, I recognize that there is a difference between working within the rules that God has established and totally violating them. I mean, totally violating them demonstrates a level of autonomy from creation that's even more striking than working within them. But I think most of the time the issue is, see, this is why if we were to say, yeah, sometimes quail get blown in, or every now and again, every 1,000 years, in some little pot in the corner of the world that nobody notices turns into wine and then stays that way for a while and goes back to water and everybody missed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we turned out that there was something in creation that made something like that happen, cosmic rays or something like that, doesn't change the fact that what's significant is Jesus says, oh, you don't have any wine?
Right.
That's the thing that the miracles seem to me are trying to say.
Right. Right.
The aspect, though, of you getting back to speaking about, well, okay. In my early upbringing, and teaching, it was essential in the culture that I came up in that we believed in this supernatural aspect of God. And what you're speaking about, and we've talked about over the years, particularly with the miracles, would have been absolute heresy.
Yeah.
And I think we know that, and I'm beginning to, and I'd like you to develop this out for me a little bit if this is of interest. It seems to me that it was, and I'm talking like the last 50 years, more or less, with the advent of television and evangelical
television ministries, so to speak. That what you, well, even in churches, it didn't matter if it was TV or not. That it was essential that God could do something supernatural, that he would not use the rational, logical laws of physics and chemistry, but had to do something that was supernatural outside of that, because it seemed that then he could bless someone else to do that, so that you had personalities who now channeled God's power to do healing or whatever else. And what it seems to me, and what you're saying, I realize that's so repugnant about that, is that takes on actually, first of all, it does away with the context, does away of attributing God to certain things, but to man himself. It's another step, it seems, in the direction for us to take control of this planet and of this earth and of our destinies, or it's part of, it's a reflection of our rebellion against God, it seems to me. So I don't know if I'm being too black and white or too drastic on that sort of thing, but it seems important.
Well, I think that's a direction that things, a person's thinking can go in. When this issue came up, I decided, well, I'll resolve this. I've got a book on my shelf that should answer all of these questions. So I pulled C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, off the shelf. And in reading it, I realized he doesn't have anything to say to this issue, because he's only thinking in two categories. Either someone believes that God is active in the world, or one believes that there's chemistry and physics, but there is no real God working behind it. Those are his only two categories. He's not really addressing the question that I'm asking, and that is, does God restrict himself to abiding by the rules of chemistry and physics as he works in the world, or does he not? And C.S. Lewis doesn't address that at all. And I think it's just because that, I suspect C.S. Lewis was just thinking about things a little differently, such that that issue didn't come to mind. It wasn't part of the debate. And I would say that usually, if someone is looking for a naturalistic explanation for a sign, they're trying to find some way to discount the divine activity. I'm not doing that at all. I'm convinced that those are God's doing. The only question is, how did he do it?
Early in my philosophical, theological career, it seemed to me that it was important that they be breaking the laws of physics, but I think I've come to realize that that's a hangover from a paradigm that we inherited from the Enlightenment, because the view of the world that got foisted on us during the Enlightenment was a mechanistic model, that the world is this clockwork machine that's running. And so in order for God to do something outside of the mechanism of nature, he had to shove a monkey wrench in the gear and stop it and do something else to interfere with it, because even God was incapable of accomplishing anything except through mechanism. And so the idea that we're violating the laws of nature when a miracle happens, I think, is born of that model. It seems to me that we have to have another model, and that is the one that you were hinting at, and that is that God is really directly the creator of everything from the sunrise to the sunset and everything in between. And because God is actually directly the author of all those things, anything that we call a natural law is not some mechanism built into reality that must be violated or cannot be violated, but rather is just simply a commitment on God's part to create a universe with a certain order to it. So it's not like it's difficult for God to violate it or deviate from it. He could at a heartbeat, but he just normally doesn't, and he typically doesn't. I've changed my mind now, whereas I used to see a naturalistic explanation of a miracle as somehow undermining the miracle. I think you could look at it another way, like the quail, for example. The fact that it is precedented in other contexts that don't involve God performing a sign or a miracle means that this doesn't have to be made up legend. I mean, that's the other side of it, is that people look at this and say, this is just ridiculous, this is just silly. Quails falling from the sky, that's silly. And so this can't be true, this can't be historical, this can't be for real. well, if you have it happening as a natural phenomenon every now and then obviously it's not silly. It can happen, and it's just all the more remarkable that it happened at a time where it was meaningful, in a context that was meaningful. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, isn't there also literature that talks about grapes being blown from France and fermenting on the way and falling in Palestine?
Not yet. But.
I wanted to bring up the issue that came up earlier in the questioning on the difference between God violating natural laws, such as chemistry and physics and that kind of thing, and God violating logic. If God can violate chemistry and physics, why couldn't he violate logic? And this is the way I've always thought about that, and I was wondering what you thought. It seems to me that the relationship between God and logic is sort of like the relationship between us and the natural laws. And the relationship between God and the natural laws is sort of like the relationship between us and our legislated laws. That our bodies are, the natural laws are, we're part of them. We can't violate the natural laws because they make up what we are, at least our physical part. So there's nothing we can do, but we can do whatever we want with our legislation. And if we decide that the maximum speed limit is 55, it's going to be 55. And if we later want to change it to 65, we can do that. And if it's going to be 70, you know, there's no problem. So in the same way as we, because the natural laws make up who our physical part are, and so therefore we can't control them. We can manipulate them according to the laws, but we can't abrogate them. In the same way, God, that logic is part of who God is. God did not invent logic. He is logic. It's who he is. He can't abrogate it because he can't not be himself. And it would be, I think it's kind of a pseudo-spirituality when people say, you know, God is not limited by logic. It's kind of a pious-sounding thing, but it's actually absurd, because if God wasn't limited by logic, it wouldn't make any sense for him to say, you know, that he is good, for instance, because he could also be bad at the same time. Mm-hmm. That would be a violation of logic, but he's God, he can do that. Well, it wouldn't make any sense then. So does that make sense, that logic is a different kind of a law from a physical law?
That sounds very good to me. That sounds very reasonable. It's a helpful distinction. Let me take just the last, if you don't mind, let me just take 5 minutes to talk about, I want to re-summarize what I talked about last week, because I was pressed for time. And I think it's a significant, at least in my thinking, it's really significant what happened to the Israelites as they were asked to go into the land, and they refused to do so. They thought it was too dangerous. They were going to get destroyed, even though God told them to go in and that he would help them to succeed. Here is a group of people that have been uniquely enabled to see God's hand at work over about a year and a half period of time, from the time that they were in Egypt to the time that they are at the southern edge of Palestine. They have seen God work incredible wonders in Egypt, and then as they came out of Egypt, the splitting of the Red Sea, and then the providing of the manna, the providing of the water, the quail, the cloud was visible every day, and the pillar of fire by night. They had all kinds of indications of God's care and concern for them, a provision for them, and guidance for them. It is then astounding to think that they wouldn't trust him when he said that they should go into the promised land. But in reflecting on it, it seems to me that it is actually consistent with human nature. And I could see myself distrusting God at that point as well. Because you begin to see those things as just what happens. It's just, sure, there's a cloud there. There's always a cloud there. There's been one every day for a long time. And cease to see the significance of it. And I mentioned last time, it's kind of like someone is an adolescent. And their parents cleaning the house, washing clothes, doing all kinds of things for them, and an adolescent just takes it for granted. I mean, that's part of being an adolescent, is being prone to just take that sort of thing for granted. It takes maturity to see that for what it is, to see the significance of that, and to appreciate it. So if you put yourself in the place of the Israelites as they're proceeding through the desert, what they're going to do is take for granted those things that God is doing to provide for them, and they'll do something very human, and that is focus on their own discomfort in the moment. The sun's hot. My mouth's dry. There's sand between my toes. It's those kinds of things that become preoccupying. That's the way we are as human beings, is to preoccupy ourselves with the discomforts of the moment and lose the bigger picture and lose sight of those things that God is doing, which are genuinely acts of love and care and concern for us on a day-by-day basis. If you think about it, God provides for us constantly. I mean, the fact that we are alive today is a gracious act on God's part. The fact that we have food to eat is a gracious act on God's part. The fact that we have health is a gracious act on God's part. The fact that we have relationships with other people that are satisfying and fulfilling, that is an act of God's grace for us. And we lose track of that. We take that all for granted. It's very easy to do that. But the most important act of God's love towards us is what He's doing in our souls, the transformation that He's bringing about, and the process that He's taking us through to release us, to free us from our slavery to sin. That's incredible. I mean, what greater act of love could there be? And yet that's something that's happening on a day-by-day basis. I don't have the rest of my notes. But I think that it is helpful and it's important for us to be able to step back and gain the kind of maturity to look at the world and see God's love where it is, to see God's goodness and grace where it is, and not lose perspective. And that, too, is a gift from God. But it is important for us to not take what He's doing for granted, because if we take it for granted, we'll be in the same situation as the Israelites, and we will be resistant to going into the promised land. We'll say, no, it's too dangerous, can't be done. So I don't think their situation is so different that we can't relate to what they're experiencing and the rebelliousness that they struggle with. Let's pray. Father, You have indeed been incredibly gracious to us. You are a loving God. It is true that life gets very difficult. There are lots of times when the pain of life is overwhelming. And some people experience a greater amount of pain than others. When I think of what some other people have been through, it seems absolutely unimaginable to me. And yet, there is something that You are doing through that whole process. That discomfort is not there because You like to subject us to discomfort. It's there because You have higher purposes that You're bringing about. Your goal is not to make our lives as pain-free as possible. Your goal is to help us to understand who we are and who You are and what You're doing in our lives and bringing us to a place where we trust You and we value what You value. I pray that You will continue to work in our lives to bring that to pass. Thank You. In Jesus' name, amen.